Accession number 17643, Reel 2.
Mr. Morton, Reel 2. What reason did your CO give for your not having the chance to get into action?
Well, we knew the reason was that he'd got enough pilots for the aircraft that he'd got. Aircraft were in short supply. Pilots were rife. There were plenty of them. And so we asked him for either flying or posting, and we both got posted. I went to 616 Squadron at Curtin Lindsay in Lincolnshire. And it was like sunlight breaking through clouds. Everyone there was delighted to see me. They all praised my flying when I did some. And, everything was perfect. I flew with them on practices. And, oh, yes, I had one wonderful moment. In close formation, I'd always been annoyed by the fact that the updraft from the leader's wing going under my wing meant that I had to hold the stick hard over to the left the whole time if I was on his right. And it got very tiring after a bit, a strain in that direction. I could have pulled or pushed, but a sideways strain on your arm. And then it occurred to me, that updraft was the tip vortex blowing my wing upward. I mustn't do that. the tip vortex pushing my wing upward. But the vortex had to come down nearer the fuselage. And so, if I pushed in a bit further, I'd get the downdraft on my wing as well as the updraft, and I wouldn't have any of that sideways strain. And I tried that, and it worked beautifully. I pushed right in very close to him, my wing fitting more or less, my wingtip into the curve of his wing root, and flew like that. And it worked. It worked so well that apparently other people had noticed it. And on one occasion, when we were told that the American Eagles squadron, the first squadron of Americans, was going to take up residence on the other side of our aerodrome, we saw them come in very ragged formation, and they landed and taxied over to their side. And the CO rang me up from A flight, and he said, "Butch, get your engine running. We're going to show these Americans what real formation flying is." And so he was out on the aerodrome. I taxied out to him, and we took off. Well, I don't know what he did. I just kept my wing slotted in behind his. And occasionally beyond it I could see sky. Sometimes I could see ground. Sometimes I could see rows of faces. And after we'd been doing that for a bit, he landed again. I was still with him. I stuck by him right through the landing. And then we taxied back to our respective dispersal huts, and as soon as I'd got inside, he rang up again. He said, "Butch, that was absolutely marvellous. Do you know, several times I'll swear your propeller wasn't 4 inches from my wingtip." I was shaking as I put the telephone down. I hadn't thought of my prop. I'd been watching my wingtip, not my propeller. I never flew quite as close again. Anyway, after a time, we went to Tangmere. The whole squadron. We flew down to Tangmere and took up residence there. And that was where we were joined by Douglas Bader, Dog's Body, as he liked to be called. Well, of course, he was already a legend. People had talked about him a lot, and the newspapers had spoken of him. And he proved to be, to me, a wonderful chap. He was in A flight, I was in B, so I didn't see all that much of him, except, of course, when he called us in to discuss the next phase, and what are you going to do. He was a marvellous leader. Of course, it was a great shame that our own squadron leader, Burton, who was a very nice chap, was being pushed out of the limelight altogether because Bader always wanted his own people on his right and left. Poor old Burton never seemed to get a nose in. He was somewhere out in the formation. Anyway, we carried on at Tangmere for quite a long time, eventually, of course. Very shortly after we arrived, a blackboard appeared on A Flight's door. Bader's Bus Service. Daily trips to the continent. return tickets only. Well, yes, we had daily trips, sometimes two a day, and everything went swimmingly. And then I was told that our first Spitfire 5B with cannons had arrived, and I was asked to go and test it over the sea, over the channel. I can't imagine even now why I was chosen, because I know everyone on the squadron would have loved to try the cannons out, but still, there was my job. So I trotted over happily to the hangar and saw the flight sergeant. He said, "Oh, I know what you've come for, Sergeant. It's not quite ready yet. We've just got to line the cannons up. Can you leave it till this afternoon?" And I said, "Yes, righto." And as soon as I'd had lunch, I went down again. He said, "We're nearly ready now, Sergeant, but you'll just have to wait another half hour." During that half hour, another sweep was called over France. And so all the time I was flying, I was terrified that somebody else might be testing that machine, but they weren't. When I got back, it was still there. And he said, "Yes, well, it's hardly worth taking it off tonight, is it, Sergeant? Come down in the morning." So in the morning I went down, and while he was still explaining that it needed a little more attention, another sweep was called. I went off on it. Got back just before lunch. He said, "Yes, after lunch, Sergeant, it'll be ready for you." After lunch, as I was on my way to the hangar, another sweep was called. And that was the one I didn't come back from. I'd lost my return half of the ticket. And so, as far as I know, there's still a Spitfire 5B waiting for me to test at Tangmere. I've never been back there to see, but I hope it's still there.
When you went off on these sweeps, how much action did you see?
Oh, quite a bit. Yes, I should have mentioned that, shouldn't I? Not every sweep. Sometimes one came back without having seen a single black cross. But occasionally there was quite a melee. I was got twice. The first time, of course, the point was the Germans, they waited up about 5,000 feet above us. When they could see a squadron of ours, they came down almost vertically, up behind it, at a hell of a speed, naturally they'd acquired in the dive, one long burst on the rearmost aircraft, and away. The first time that happened to me, I was the trailing aircraft of a squadron. I was jinking from side to side to see what was coming up behind, but I missed those. And all that happened was that I heard sundry bangs up and down inside the fuselage, and and my engine started giving out white smoke, and the cockpit filled up with white smoke. I couldn't see a damn thing. I turned on my back and went into a dive to get out of the trouble. And then I couldn't open my hood because, of course, the streamlining was such that the hood was held closed if you were going very fast. But eventually I managed to wrench it back. The smoke cleared as if by magic, and I was able to level out and continue going towards France, at least towards the channel, I was over France already. I wanted to head for the channel to ditch there, because obviously I wasn't going to be able to fly much longer, in the hope that I'd be picked up by the British rather than the Germans. My engine was sounding like a cement mixer. My oil pressure gauge was off the mark completely. There was no pressure, no oil pressure left. Oil temperature was off the scale at the top, and the whole aircraft was vibrating, but still, it was still flying. I thought at least I might get to the channel. And then the awful thing happened. A German 109 coming up behind. We got into the defensive circle where we were circling round each other, and neither could fire at the other. And then suddenly, he broke away and dived back the way he'd come. Now, I think that may have been the last example of chivalry in modern warfare. He saw what a mess I was in, and he let me go, although he could have added one to his score so easily. Anyway, I kept on going. As I say, the engine was sounding dreadful, and it went on limping all the way across the channel, and I was able to land at Hawkinge with all eyes on me, because of course I was trailing smoke like blazes. It would have been a beautiful landing, except that one of my tyres had been blown to pieces, and so it was rather an ungainly one. Now, action on these sweeps was very... Well, as I say, their method of attacking meant one long burst and they were away, so that nothing went on. We didn't have long dogfights, which I would have enjoyed. I had had a dogfight, which I should have mentioned before, over the south coast, but still. And eventually...
Don't go back to it.
May I?
Yes, certainly.
Right. I'd taken a couple of new members of the squadron up for a practice dogfight over the south coast. And I'd got them up to 10,000 feet, and I put them in line astern, ready to start the mock fight. And then I saw two aircraft approaching, which were obviously Hurricanes, because they had rounded wingtips, not Spitfires. They were about 1,000 feet above us and coming the other way. So I waited till they'd come level with us, and then they both turned on their backs, and as they did so, I saw yellow noses, which of course was the mark of a 109, a German 109. The yellow noses, I think, must have been because they were having the same difficulty that I always did in telling friend from foe. Black crosses and roundels are not easily seen, but a yellow painted nose certainly is. Anyway, these were obviously 109s, so I turned on my back and went after them and gave chase, and I called out to my two new members of the squadron, "Come on, chaps, this is the real thing." I forgot all about tally-ho and so on, although this was my first fight. And we had read in our intelligence notes that a Spitfire had the legs of a 109 in level flight. Well, these two leveled out, and I was behind them. I'd lost my two friends by then. One of them had just found himself alone in the sky, and the other one had tried to follow me down and had eardrum trouble with the changes of pressure. So I was on my own by then, but I didn't know. And I gave chase to these 109s, and I found, to my annoyance, they were getting away from me. And I followed them right across to France, and they were still getting away, and I knew there'd be plenty of 109s over France ready to have a bash at me. So I turned back and made for England. On the way, I remembered to tell the controller what had been happening, because, of course, he knew nothing about it at all. And he said, "Well, that's all very well. Are you all right?" And I said, "Fine, thanks. How are you?" Which seemed to make things all right. Now, let's go back to where I was, which was the day I was shot down. It was an ordinary sweep, and as usual, somebody on the way back, somebody had come down behind me from heaven knows what height and given me a long burst. This time it was rather different from what it had been before, because my engine, after being very rough for a bit, suddenly stopped. One propeller blade sticking up in silent immobility in front of me. And I tried every way of starting it again, and nothing worked at all. And I realized I'd got to land. Well, there was no difficulty. There was an enormous field, I think it was a wheat field, below me, with no obstructions, no ditches, no hedges, nothing. There was a large house, but I deliberately steered away from that, because I didn't want to give the owner the agonizing choice of hiding me with the probability of losing his house or of giving me up and feeling a traitor. So I did a wheels-up landing very easily. And then, of course, there was the difficulty of getting rid of my aircraft. I had a couple of port fires, which I'd forgotten about. I didn't have the usual revolver, which I'd always intended to use. There was one less than the number of pilots, so somebody always had to be without. On that occasion, it was me. But I remembered also that the day before, the CO had said, when somebody questioned whether somebody else had destroyed his aircraft, He said, well, for heaven's sake, the Germans have got enough Spit-2s by now, another one wouldn't make any difference. So I left the thing as it was and started walking through this wheat field, tearing up all my mess bills that I still had with me, because, of course, they had the squadron lettering on, squadron number on them, pushing them well down into the wheat. And eventually a couple of German Erks privates came over towards me, and I put my hands up and surrendered. And that was that.
Before we go into your POW experience, could I ask you about morale in the squadron on these sweeps?
Absolutely top. I don't remember anyone moaning. Well, of course, Bader was a wonderful influence. He was always cheerful and straightforward, and one felt with him one was absolutely safe.
Why do you think that a number of people have criticised Bader since the war?
That baffles me. Well, of course, I must admit, I was an NCO. I wasn't in the officers' mess, so I didn't see very much of him. They must have seen more of him than I did. But as far as I could see, he was absolutely the right man for the job, a fine leader, and anyone would have followed him anywhere.
Can you say, for those who don't know, what a sweep was and what it was intended to effect?
Yes. The Germans had been coming over Britain for during the Battle of Britain, carrying the war over Britain. And Bader, well, in fact, it seemed like Bader mostly, but probably the whole of the British intelligence, said, all right, now they can't come over Britain anymore. We've got our defences right. We'll take the war into Germany for a change. We'll do all the fighting over France, actually, occupied France, of course. We'll take it over their side, which is what we were doing. And harrying them generally, just being a nuisance, I think.
How much do you think that was achieved on the sweeps that you personally took part in?
I wouldn't have the slightest idea. I'm sorry, but we didn't bother. We were told to go on a sweep, and we went on a sweep, and sometimes enjoyed it, sometimes less so.
Now, when you were first arrested by the enemy, what was their demeanour towards you?
Well, these two privates, they were just rather pleased to have found me. On the way, walking back to their headquarters, they saw another two privates with a prisoner, and they shouted to him, and they couldn't make him attract his attention, so I gave one of them my whistle that I'd got with me, and he was very pleased. He blew the whistle, and the other chap saw him, and that was that. That was what's known as making friends with the enemy, I suppose. And they took me to their headquarters, and I saw one or two people, and then I was put in a room on my own with a telephone. And every now and again, somebody would come into the room to use the telephone, look at me rather curiously, and go out. I was there about 2 or 3 hours, I should think. And finally, they led me outside to where there was a van, a very high German van. And yes, I was sitting on the driver's right, naturally. On our left was a farmhouse, and a lovely old, well, not old, middle-aged woman in an apron, looking for the perfect farmer's wife. It was a very sunny day, and she was shading her eyes with her arm, and I leant across, the driver happened to lean down to speak to somebody, I leant across him and put my thumb up, and she wiggled her fingers, was the most she dared to do, in reply. Then I was driven to a railway station, and, oh no, I think I was driven straight to, yes, Duleg Luft, the reception camp. I can't remember exactly where it was, near Frankfurt. I didn't go straight into Duleg Luft, the reception camp. I went to the hospital. Now, I wasn't even chop-soiled, but the hospital was a sort of entrance place. You went to the hospital first and then into the camp so that you could be interrogated in the hospital because you had a room to yourself. Well, I had this very pleasant room to myself. Out of the window, I saw there was a postern parading up and down, so there was no escape that way. Anyway, I was willing to wait for a better opportunity to escape. And then I was questioned by the Gestapo, a very large, burly man in the usual green Macintosh and a hat, a peaked hat, which had across the front British Red Cross and Order of St. John of Jerusalem with the two symbols. And he put that on the table in front of me because he'd seated me at a table and turned it carefully so that I shouldn't fail to see the two the two symbols in front of me. And then he took out a sheet of paper and put that down and said, "Will you fill this in, please?" Well, the first question, name, that was all right. Rank, yes. Number, yes. Squadron, oh. And I looked further down. Group, station, and further on, weather bombs dropped, etc., etc. And I said, "I'm sorry, I can't fill this in." And he said, "You can. There's no reason why you shouldn't." And I said, "But look, these are things that..." He said, "That the Germans will not know. I am Geneva. I am British Red Cross and Order of St. John. The Germans do not get this paper. This goes straight back to England," or something like that. And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, but even so, I'm not allowed to fill it in." And he went on and he said, you really, there's no reason why you shouldn't. The Germans must have all this information." Well, I knew that they knew what squadron I was in because I'd landed my aircraft with the squadron letters on the side, so I did fill in the squadron, that was all, 616. And he seemed satisfied with that. And eventually I was released into the camp itself, where I met my old CO, at least the B flight commander, a very nice chap, who had been shot down about a week before me. And also one other chap, a sergeant pilot, at least he had been a sergeant pilot when I knew him, on 74 Squadron. Now he was a PO and with a medal, a DFM. I was there for about a week, I should think, and then a lot of us were rounded up and put on a bus to go to the station to be taken to 9C. 9C, Bad Salza.
Is this Stalag or Stalag Luft?
No, it's neither. It was Bad Salza was... Yes, it was a Stalag Luft 9C, our part of it, although it was already filled with French, Belgians, and a few old Serbian peasants, who I was very sorry for. But it was mostly, we were in a hut. There were about 150 of us in one end, one room of the hut. There was another room at the other end with a washroom between. And I couldn't work out what nationality the people in the other room were. I heard them in the washroom. They always conversed in shouts, and I couldn't make out what the language was at all. I couldn't catch any words that I recognized. Eventually, it turned out they were a Scottish regiment that had been captured at Dunkirk. Shouting in broad Scottish, I just couldn't understand them. Anyway, everything went well at 9C. It was a very friendly sort of atmosphere. And we had a chap in our lot, Fairy Evans, and he admitted quite openly a homosexual. But he was also, he'd been a professional entertainer. He'd had a little piano act, a duo with another chap, and he got it into his head that he could do some entertaining. in the army section, that is the other end of our hut. Well, I knew these were going on Saturday evenings, but I hadn't been for some time, and then eventually I did filter through. They just cleared a space. People were all round, just leaning on beds and that sort of thing. There were three-tier bunks there, and people would just walk out and do an act. It might be just singing a song, or it might be telling a few jokes. There was a sergeant major who knew two jokes. We heard them repeatedly, both very blue, of course. There was one chap who always sang like a ukulele lady, but he didn't know the second eight bars, so he just left those out and went straight on to the middle eight. It was all good, clean fun, and eventually I worked out an act for myself just before Christmas, and that went down like wildfire, and so I started doing them regularly. I wouldn't repeat myself, of course, so I used... Well, I say this was the first act, and the next week I did, a Stanley Holloway monologue or something like that, and then there were various other poems and things that I had stored up. I was able to keep going. 9C. There was something else I was going to say, but I can't remember now. Anyway, eventually, we were posted. From 9C... we went to Sagan. That was Stalag Luft 3. Yes, the place where the wooden horse was, but that was in the officer's compound. The two compounds were side by side, the Oflag and the Stalag, side by side. And it was, of course, all brand new stuff. The huts were new, the field was new, and the field was... it had been a pine... Well, the whole place had been a pine forestation. They'd cut down the trees, but only just above ground level, so that our playing field was a mass of tree stumps. And they were huge. When you pulled one, got one out of the ground, which meant a lot of digging around it, you found it was the size of an aircraft radial engine and just as heavy. But, of course, it was fuel, and fuel was always needed. And so it was arranged that each hut should get a tree root in turn until they'd all been used up. And I remember when ours was brought in and flung on the floor by about five people carrying it. And there it sat. And we were allowed to borrow a felling axe from the Germans, as long as it went back in the evening, of course. And our room leader, he got hold of this, he was a big strong chap, got hold of this felling axe, took a huge swipe at this tree root or stump on the floor, and the axe bounced off with a yeah, 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 yeah sort of sound, and left no mark whatever on the stump. And he took another swing, and again the same result. All the strongest men in the hut took it in turn to try to do this, and eventually one said, "We'd better get Jake." Jake was a lumberjack. I'd never met him, well, most of us hadn't, but he was known to be in the camp, and he had been a lumberjack. So somebody went for Jake, and he came in. Tall, lanky, stringy,